You're listening to Sports Connections with David Smale, the show that brings you a fun and intimate look into connections throughout sports. Now here's your host, David Smale.
Joe Posnanski has been receiving awards for his sports writing since he covered the very first baseball game in history. You know, in Genesis 1-1, in the big inning, God created the heavens and the earth. He attended UNC Charlotte and got his first job in journalism at the Charlotte Observer. He later worked as a columnist in Cincinnati and Augusta, Georgia, before coming to the Kansas City Star as a columnist in 1996. He stayed with the Star for the next 13 years before joining the team at Sports Illustrated. Joe is now a senior writer at The Athletic, and he has been named National Sports Writer of the Year by five different organizations. He's also won two Emmys as part of NBC's Digital Olympics coverage. He's the author of five books, including his most recent title, The Life and Afterlife of Harry Houdini. His columns masterfully weave humor and personal opinions and stories with the sports stories of the day. The best thing about Joe is he's not afraid to laugh at himself, and we're going to try and get him to do that today. So, Joe, welcome to Sports Connections.
It's great to be here.
But what first attracted you to writing about sports?
Well, I often say that I began writing about sports because I failed out of accounting in college, which is mostly true. I was always a sports fan as a kid. I grew up loving sports, played, you know, not always well, but always with enthusiasm, and loved it. And, you know, I mean, I suppose that's the story of every young sports writer, or most of them, I suppose. But I didn't really connect writing until I got to college and truly did fail out of accounting and needed to find something that I could do. And I, you know, I really had no reason to believe that that I could be a sports writer. I had nobody had ever told me that I was had any talent whatsoever as a writer. So it took a little while to develop confidence. But that's really, once I started writing, it was definitely going to be sports, just because that was what I knew. Yeah. It's what I liked. And that's sort of where I suppose it began.
One of the reasons I like reading your stuff, and when you were the columnist for the Star, that was the very first thing I did every morning, is get the paper and see what Joe had to say. Where does your sense of humor come from?
My sense of humor. I always think of Mel Brooks' line when they asked him where his sense of humor came from, and he said he found it in a box on the corner of 118th. It has to come from my family. My father is a very, very funny person, still is very funny. We go when he's had some health issues. When he's in the hospital, he's the one the nurses seem to gravitate toward.
Sure.
I just grew up in a very funny house. I mean, my mom is funny in very different ways than my dad, but also very funny. I think it's really, you know, you hear that story again and again, that there's a certain power you find when you can make your parents laugh. And so that was always a big thing for me growing up, was trying to crack everybody in the family up. I was nothing close to a class clown or anything like that. Yeah. I was way too shy and reserved and distant, I think, as a kid. But in the house, it was always important, and I would do anything, you know, to make my family laugh, my parents laugh, and so, you know, I find humor to be a fascinating thing, because it's much different being funny than it is writing funny. I mean, they're very, very different, and I didn't know that I could write funny. You know, obviously I didn't know that I could write at all. So that came as a very, you know, I just started writing things that I thought were funny. And mm-hmm. of course you never really know if people are going to laugh, you know, that you don't get to see them. And then people started saying, oh, I read your thing this morning and I was laughing out loud in the coffee shop or something like that. And then you thought, oh, well, maybe I can do this. So it definitely builds for my family, but it's something that, as a writer, I think you constantly have to work on.
Yeah, you can't force it, for sure. Yeah. was there one column or one story when they went, you know, I could use this humor. Was there one thing that you remember and say, well, that column put me into the mode where I was confident using humor in my stories?
I don't know if there's a column that there's a story I tell, which is 100% true. I was in a class, an English class, in college. It was after I had failed out of accounting and I'd switched majors and I'd become an English major. And I was in an English class and there was an assignment that we were given to, we were supposed to record the conversation between two different characters, figure out what they were, characters from different books. And we were supposed to say, what would happen if, you know, these two characters gone. But the way that the thing was described, the question was posed, you are a fly on the wall and you are overhearing this conversation between these two people. And I don't think I was all that familiar with the phrase fly on the wall. So I literally wrote it as if I was a fly on the wall. That's literally how I wrote it. So I would have the conversation going and then in the middle, I would break off and I would say, oh wait, there's a hot dog there. I need to get to the hot dog. And I was avoiding fly swatters. And I, you know, I thought it was funny because I didn't really know what it meant. But the teacher, it was the first time I'd ever even tried anything like that. And I remember getting the paper back and the teacher wrote on it. And you know, it was a real turning point for me. He wrote, you know, now I'm teaching you in my class. Someday I want to teach you to my class, which I thought was an incredible thing for a, you know, 19-year-old kid to hear.
Yeah.
But it was definitely like, okay, this is who you are. You need to try to do this. So I think that once I started writing columns, I tried to be funny. Early on, I think it was a failure on many, many levels, you know? But I think you have to go. I mean, if you're going to try to be that kind of columnist and you're going to try to make people laugh, you got to take chances and push the envelope and it doesn't always work, but you keep going.
You know, my all time favorite column, because you and I've talked about this. It was in the 2003 season and the Chiefs, that was the year they started 9-0 and ended up being the number one seed and ended up losing in the first round again because they couldn't force a punt Peyton Manning and the Colts. But this was maybe 6 or 7 weeks in, and it was your midweek column, which was less about the upcoming game. It was just stuff. And you know, I said in the introduction that you've put your personal experiences in and your humor and stuff. So you know what column I'm talking about.
Yeah.
But let's see if I can do it justice. I don't have it in front of me, and so I'm not reading it anywhere. I'm obviously looking into the camera, but it was something like, you start out, folks, I have a problem and I need your help.
Yeah.
I got a call yesterday from my brother who told me he is getting married in the second Saturday of January. And he asked me to be his best man, which brings about a couple of questions. First of all, who in their right mind gets married the second Saturday in January? But the second one is more of a personal problem, because I have to figure out what I'm going to do. If the Chiefs continue on their current trajectory, they're going to host a playoff game that weekend, and it's just as likely to be on that Saturday as it is the Sunday. And so I have to decide, do I be the best man for my only brother for his wedding? You know, we're best friends, we grew up together, give all these reasons and stuff, or do I honor my job? And my job is to cover the most important points in sports in Kansas City. And, you know, I probably wouldn't lose my job if I told him I couldn't cover, but it's really a responsibility that I take seriously. And so there's my problem. And we all know what I should do. But then again, he is my brother.
Yeah, you know, that column got me in a little trouble with my brother's in-laws. They didn't know me very well and didn't didn't know I was joking. So they took that seriously, at least somewhat seriously. And so I heard a little bit about that, but that column, you know, it to me, that was sort of what I tried to do in Kansas City. The one that I think of all the time was when I went to, I guess, Hutchinson for the women's U.S. Open. They had the women's U.S. Open right there in Hutchinson, Kansas. And I brought my family with me, and my daughter had just been born. She was almost a year old, I guess. And I brought my wife, and we stayed in this, you know, hotel in Hutch, and it was quite the thing. And of course, you know, U.S. Women's Open's a big deal, and it was the biggest tournament they'd had there in Hutch in many, many years, if ever. And on the second day, I think it was before the tournament started, but it was like on the second day of practice rounds, I think. And maybe it was after the tournament had actually begun, but I think it was, I know it was early in the week, whether the tournament had started or not. My daughter, Elizabeth, took her first step as she literally between the bed and the television, there was like a little area. She'd already been standing for a while. She was standing up next to the bed, and then she took her first steps to the thing. And I thought, you know, I'm here. You know, the star sent me here to cover a golf tournament, a big golf tournament. And I didn't write about it. I wrote about my daughter taking her first steps. and you know, in funny, you know, tried to be funny about it. But to me, that was what I felt like I brought to the table, was that I was going to be personal, hopefully be funny, hopefully be self-effacing, and be your friend. I mean, that was really what I wanted to be as a columnist, and I loved it. You know, I loved my time in Kansas City, and still think of Kansas City as home. I mean, we were talking during a week where my hometown Cleveland Browns are playing the Kansas City Chiefs, and I'm in a house where the family is at war. My two daughters, one likes the Browns, one likes the Chiefs. So we got a lot going on here.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, I just think that what that opportunity did in Kansas City, that time as columnist in Kansas City, it altered my life in every possible way.
Well, you're kind of dancing around it a little bit. But to me, it's what made you such a good writer, makes you such a good writer. I shouldn't put it in past tense. is the fact that you're very personal. People feel like they may have never met you, but they feel like they know you because you tell them things about your own life. And going back to that column, I remember reading it at the time. I worked for, can't remember where I was working for, the Fellowship of Christian Athletes. And I had the paper with me, and I called my brother at work, and he is laughing when he answers the phone. I said, "What are you laughing at?" He goes, "I'm reading Posnansky's column." And I said, "That's why I called you, you know, to read that to you." And we were both best man in each other's wedding. Sure. He's my only brother, my only sibling. And yet we were like, okay, if you were dumb enough to get married on the second Saturday of January, I would have a problem. And so it not only was it funny, but we could relate to that, Joe, and that's what made it so good. So I have to ask you, did you make the wedding and the game?
I made them both. I don't remember exactly how it played out. It might have been that his was going to be the championship game week, like if the Chiefs had won. I don't remember.
What I remember is that it was, and tell me if I'm wrong, I remember that it was the game against the Colts, which was not the AFC championship.
Right, right.
But it was the, like, maybe his wedding was on a Saturday and the Chiefs got to play on Sunday.
Maybe that's what it was. Maybe
something
I left
like that. But so you did make the game.
I made them both. I was best man there in Florida for my brother's wedding. And I was there to watch the Chiefs lose that game that nobody punted. It was a whirlwind. I can't remember the exact details of how it happened, but I definitely ended up making both of them.
All right. That's great. So did your brother appreciate the fact that you did show up?
No, I think he was furious that I even considered not showing up. I think he just, he was taking it pretty hard from his wife's side of the family. And he was telling them, like, he's just joking.
Yeah.
He's going to be here at the wedding.
Yeah. He's just joking.
He's just joking. They didn't buy. And there were a few glares sent my way. But look, it all works out. I made it. And I think they figured out that I would have been there even if it had meant missing the Chiefs game. I think probably, I don't know if I would have or not, but I think I would have.
Yeah. And so your toast at the reception is, you know, to my brother and his new bride, all the best. I got to go.
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah, to see you at the Super Bowl. It was very, it was sweet. It was actually a very sweet wedding. And I do think at the end of the day, they were happy that I came. I hope so. I hope they were.
All right. I saw your tweet recently about the Browns and their first playoff road victory you might have been a year old, since 1969. Are you still a Browns fan, or are you a Chiefs fan, or has being a journalist in so many areas allowed you to take a 30,000 foot level and not root for anybody? Because I can't do that. I'm a Chiefs fan. I cover Chiefs, Royals, Sporting, K-State stuff, and I can write in an unbiased manner, but I'm still rooting like crazy for my teams.
Sure. I guess it's a little bit of both. I have a great deal of affection for the Chiefs, and particularly the Royals, because I still know so many of the people there in the Royals organization. But I also write a weekly diary for The Athletic about being a Browns fan, and have for years, and that's fun for me. It's what inspired my youngest daughter to become a Browns fan. And so she is a true believer, like a full fledged, kind of like what I was when I was a kid.
Yeah.
And I've always, because I'm a journalist, I've sort of kept a slight distance from that.
Yeah.
But I have to admit, being around her and feeling her enthusiasm for it, I really have regained sort of some of that passion for the Browns that I had when I was a kid, particularly this team that has ended up being so surprisingly good and just beat the Steelers in one of the, biggest wins certainly of my lifetime. So, I love the Chiefs. I watch the Chiefs every week. I give the Kansas City Star columnists, Sam Mellinger and Vahe Gregorian, hell over the fact that they get this quarterback to write about and that Chiefs to write about. And I didn't get any of that. You know, I got such flawed teams through the years. But I love watching them play and love what it has done for Kansas City. I mean, obviously this year with this past year with COVID, I never got to go back, but seeing what the town was like after the Super Bowl, I did go to Kansas City just before the pandemic really hit, and seeing the way that town, and seeing the way it was after the Royals victory, same thing.
Yeah.
I mean, it's, nothing makes me happier than seeing Kansas City in full array, and everybody, with flags in front of their houses, and there's just a joy in the city. I mean, that's, nothing beats that.
Yeah. I think that's the last time I saw you, when you were in Kansas City for the Negro Leagues centennial celebration right after the Super Bowl. So, so you're still, if you can say you're still a Browns fan, then that makes this next question appropriate. Speaking of pain, how hard was it to leave the loyal following and daily routine of being a columnist for a local paper to become a national columnist with Sports Illustrated?
It was very hard. I still think of those years as columnist for the Star as some of the happiest years of my life, and not to say that the years with Sports Illustrated weren't, they were also wonderful and joyful, and so have the years since then. I mean, I've been very, very lucky, but it was difficult because of my relationship with Kansas City. I mean, I think that's, I loved everybody I worked with at the Star, and all of them are still great friends, but there was just we've moved to Charlotte. My parents live here, wanted the girls to be close to their grandparents, but I don't feel the same way about Charlotte, and never will and never can. I mean, there was a sense in Kansas City of family and support and love that I just felt everywhere. And I hated missing out on that. You know, yeah. I wanted to be there to write when the Royals finally got good. I wanted to be there to write when the Chiefs finally won the Super Bowl. But that said, you know, an opportunity like Sports Illustrated comes along. I mean, it had been a dream of mine since I was a kid, and getting to do that was, you know, I wouldn't change anything. But you know, it's been interesting for me that I've had to make choices in my life where both choices are great. You know, I mean, it's like it's where it's like, oh, I'm leaving something so good behind, but I'm going to something so good. And boy, that's what a lucky life that is, to be able to have that happen to you again and again.
Yeah, for sure. Now, you've covered the Olympics, which I have had the opportunity to do as well, and all the local sports you could absorb in four different markets. What's your favorite all-time beat?
Well, there's nothing like covering the Olympics.
Yeah.
I mean, just those, you know, just those 3 weeks. I did 10 of them, and those 3 weeks, you know, leading into the Olympics and coming right out of the Olympics, you know, the Olympics themselves, about 2 weeks. It's like entering a different world. And obviously in some places it really is. I mean, you're suddenly you find you're in Beijing or you're in Sydney or you're in Athens and you're in Russia. I mean, it's like, wow. I mean, how did this happen? But also the sports, it's so self-contained that everything you need to know and want to know is happening somewhere around you. You know, it's you're completely separated from the rest of the sports world, the rest of the political world. You're just entirely in there. And I love that. I mean, I couldn't live there forever, but for 3 weeks, you know, every 2 years, to be able to just sort of enter this other planet. And, you know, and many of the greatest things, I always say that the greatest thing that I've ever seen was a Greco-Roman wrestling match between Rulon Gardner and Alexander Karelin. I mean, that, you know, I didn't know the rules. I didn't understand, I didn't know either person. I knew nothing about any of it. But it's the greatest thing I've ever seen. And so, you know, I'd say in the Olympics, I mean, it doesn't feel like a beat to me though. It feels to me like it's like I say, entering a different world. I mean, baseball and football have been my two biggest things. But you know, getting to cover and write at length about, you know, Bill Self's Kansas teams that, you know, the one that won it all. And that was incredible. Even Roy Williams' Kansas teams that fell short, Bill Snyder's Kansas State football teams. And especially when they came so close to a national title, you know, it's Missouri when they had their incredible runs. One of the greatest things I've ever seen was that Kansas Missouri football game when they were 1-3 in the country or 2-3 or whatever. Yeah. So, you know, I think that what I used to say all the time is that I loved whatever was in season, you know, I never felt like I could do one thing and only one thing. I wanted to be able to bounce from sport to sport and, you know, from pros to college to now it's a little different. I mean, now I definitely focus much of my energy on baseball, which is probably the sport I, you know the best or feel like I know the best. And that's great too, but it's a lot different than that feeling of every day you had no idea what you were going to do.
Yeah. It, going back to the Olympics, and I, you know, we didn't rehearse this, so I didn't know what your answer was going to be before I asked the question, but I would have guessed the Olympics and here's my reason. And maybe this isn't the reason, but here's the reason I thought you would say that is meeting the people from different parts of the world. I remember the only one I've been at was Atlanta. And I worked for ACOG for the committee for the Olympic Games. And, you know, media outlets around the world didn't have enough reporters to send one to every venue. So ACOG put together press information teams at each venue, and we would write, you know, a game story, depending on which sport it was, there was more depth to the team. We'd write game story. We'd get quotes. We'd do all these things. I covered basketball. And I mean, other than track and field, which was my first love, not because I could run, but just I liked watching it.
Sure.
Basketball at the Olympics was the epitome. And I remember sitting there watching Korea against Angola in a women's game, thinking I could find four other guys in the gym. And I wasn't much of an athlete, but I could find four other guys and beat either one of those teams. I'm bored out of my mind sitting here on a Tuesday afternoon in this sweltering gym. Wait a minute. I'm getting paid to watch basketball courtside at the Olympic Games. Yeah. Shut up. But the thing I remember the most is riding the train. I have a cousin who lived in suburban Atlanta. And so my family went with me and we stayed with him. So I'd ride the train to and from Atlanta every day. And I remember after one event and I rode the train and there was a Romanian gymnast standing next to a Russian weightlifter, standing next to a Chinese diver. And they were riding the train with this American schlep sports writer, you know, and we were in the same world. Yeah. And the personalities that you get at the Olympics, you know, if you're covering the NBA or Major League Baseball, you're going to get some prima donnas. Those people weren't. And I'm guessing that was a big part of it for you because of the way you write about people. Oh, by the way, they're athletes. Is that fair?
Very much so. Very much so. The stories of the Olympics were endless, absolutely endless. I mean, the reason I went to that Carell and Rulon Gardner match in the first place, because that was the same day that the U.S. baseball team was playing for the gold medal. So that's where almost everybody went.
Yeah.
But the reason I went there was because I was so fascinated by this Alexander Karelin, three-time gold medalist who had, was a legend in that field, in that sport, and was supposedly the kind of guy who would train by carrying refrigerators upstairs. I mean, you know, that's irresistible to me. So that story again and again and again, and, you know, just being around that, first of all, I just love the fact that everybody is from everywhere. You know, I love that you're watching an event that has, you know, 12 athletes from 12 different countries doing, you know, and each of them has their own incredible journey to this, to this moment. You know, that's the wonder of track and field. You know, I mean, one of the greatest places I've ever been was in Beijing watching, Usain Bolt, even in the preliminaries of the 100, you know, when he was just basically jogging and breaking 10 seconds. I mean, it was incredible. Yeah. But there they were. I mean, you had a runner from Jamaica and a runner from the United States and a runner from England and a runner from Russia and all of them are the fastest people in their country and they're coming to this one place for this one moment. And there's 80,000 people in the stands and their entire experience is going to last 10 seconds. And there's nothing like that. So I love the Olympics and, you know, if somebody said to me like, okay, you have one assignment left, you know, I would want it to be an Olympics. Cause that's the greatest thing. That's the greatest thing going. It's not really, I mean, it is for people who cover the Olympics. I wouldn't want to be on the Olympic beat so that I had to write about the Olympic stuff, you know, the other 2 years before they go, but the event itself, nothing like it.
You know, one of my favorite things about writing about sports is that it's different. It's always different. You can have two games on the same day between the same two teams in baseball and you will get in two entirely different storylines.
Sure.
There have never been two games that are exactly the same. And that's my favorite part. What's your favorite part about covering sports?
Well, definitely the element of you're going to see something you've never seen before. I mean, that is it's essential to sports. I mean, I think when sports start to become even a little bit repetitive, then they lose their joy and energy and all of that. For me, it's always been the stories. I mean, it's the stories of the people involved, the stories of the cities, trying to break through, the story of the fans who have dedicated their lives to it, the story of the coaches. I just think that that part of it is so endless. And that part of it is not necessarily sports, right? I mean,
right,
it's
right.
It's human. And I love that part. You know, I've got my sixth book is coming out in October, and it's a countdown of the 100 greatest baseball players ever, which I first did for The Athletic and is now going to become a book. And I'm excited about that. And I'm kind of going through it now as we're sort of finishing, doing the finishing touches on it. And, you know, here are 100 baseball players, and every single one of them has not just a different story, but I mean, a completely unique story. And I think that's why it's endlessly fascinating, is that that their stories are never, ever going to repeat. The games are never going to repeat. It's always going to have something new and different. And that's, I think, what feeds good writing, I think.
I did one of these podcasts with Bob Kendrick, and he made this statement, which I had never thought about before, but I think it's 100% true. Different from any other sport, with baseball, your favorite player when you were a kid is still your favorite player today.
Yeah. You know,
I mean, I've got two kids older than Patrick Mahomes, so he was not my favorite when I was a kid. So he's one of my favorites now. But my favorite baseball player when I was a kid was Hank Aaron, and sure, he's still my favorite player. And but that was I'd never thought about that, but I think it's absolutely true. So two questions with that. First, where is my favorite in your top 100? Where is Hank Aaron? And secondly, who is your all-time favorite player?
Well, the second part first is easy. My all-time favorite player I've written about many, many times was Dwayne Kuiper, who played second base for Cleveland when I was growing up there. The wonderful thing about Dwayne is that he didn't really do anything all that well. He hit one home run in his career. He got caught stealing more times than he was successful stealing. He was a 270 hitter or so. Played good defense, but never won a Gold Glove. But I loved him. And you know, sometimes you get really lucky. I feel like I've always been lucky, but when I grew up loving Dwayne Kuiper, I didn't realize that many years later I would meet Dwayne Kuiper. You know, that idea never crossed my mind. And so, you know, I've told this story before, but I wrote several times about how much I loved Dwayne Kuiper and about what he meant to me. And one day, a few years ago, my wife, Margot, gets an email from Dwayne Kuiper saying, hey, there's something I want to do for Joe, and I want your help. And my wife, who is a baseball fan, but not a big enough fan that she would necessarily know who Dwayne Kuiper was,
right,
other than through my stories, she writes back and says, are you the real Dwayne Kuiper? As if anybody would pretend to be Dwayne Kuiper.
Yeah.
But it ended up, he ended up sending me a bat. He said he wanted to send me this. He's like, man, my kids don't want this. So he sent me like a hat that he wore in the game and a bat. I mean, it was just, you know, and of course they're two of my most cherished possessions. So, yeah, you know, I think Bob is 100% right. I think, you know, you have a hero in baseball particularly. It's probably somewhat true in football. I mean, certainly in Kansas City, I don't think anybody ever stop loving Len Dawson, right?
Right.
You know, I mean, like, I think it happens in other sports, but it's particularly true in baseball that, you know, once you have a favorite player, you can appreciate others and love others, but you're never going to have another one like your favorite player as a kid. And, you know, some people are lucky like you that, you know, your favorite player is one of the greatest, not only players of all time, but greatest people that's ever played in the game. And then some people are lucky like me and their hero wasn't necessarily a great or good player, but one of the great people in the history of the game. And then some people, you know, pick a great player and then get disappointed by them. I mean, it's, you know, that's how it goes, but it's still, it's still permanent, you know? Yeah. I mean, it's still, if you grew up loving Reggie Jackson, you still love Reggie Jackson. I don't know. I guess I can tell you, since it is public, Hank Aaron is number 4 on my list of all-time great players. I hope people will get the book and see the complete list. But I will tell you that after the Hank Aaron story appeared, after I wrote my big, because the big thing for me was writing about these people, not so much ranking them.
Right.
And so after I wrote about Hank Aaron, I was having dinner that night with my parents, not with my parents, with my wife and kids. And phone rang, and it was a Milwaukee number. And I picked it up, and it was Bud Selig. And Bud had found my number somehow. Not that I'm hard to find. And called me, tell me how thrilled he was with what I had written about Hank Aaron, which was very, very touching. And then called me to wonder how in the heck I could put 3 people ahead of him on the list. So it was a mixed call, I would say. Yes. But what a man, and what a player. I mean, one of I've been lucky enough to interview Henry Aaron several times in public, as well as in private, and he's just one of the all-time greats.
I'll tell you why he became my favorite. I grew up in Kansas City, and we had a love-hate relationship with the A's.
Sure.
We wanted to root for them because they were our team, but they were so bad. That's how I became a Red Sox fan, because we'd always battle the Red Sox for 9th and 10th in the American League before we had divisions. Right. And I was like, okay, I'm going to root for this other team. And I still have beer on my Red Sox hat that I wore to Yankee Stadium. But, when Hank Aaron started getting attention for chasing, I think it was when he went over 500 home runs, and Willie Mays was right behind him over 500 home runs. And he got Willie Mays got all the attention because he was the Say Hey kid. He was so popular. Everybody loved him. He was great with the press. Hank didn't trust the press. And maybe it's the part of me that roots for the underdog. But I was like, I'm going to root for that guy because nobody else is. Now, you know, that obviously wasn't true. There were plenty of people who rooted for him. But I rooted for him because he wasn't getting the attention. And then I found out what a great guy he was, and it was just, it cemented it. And I've had the opportunity one time to interview him, and it's one of the highlights. In fact, but when I was talking to Bob, I mentioned that, and he said, we have that in common. He is my all-time favorite player.
He is.
He said, in the 10 years that I've been the president of the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum, he said, I've hosted 4 former U.S. presidents. I've hosted congressmen, senators, actors, hundreds of major league players. The one time I was nervous was when I gave Hank Aaron a tour of the museum, but he said he put me at ease. So that was pretty cool.
And that was true. I was there for that.
Yeah.
And Bob was very, very nervous. And it was great, 'cause we did an event that night on stage with Henry Aaron, and he's just class. There's no other way to say it. He's just pure class.
All right, great transition into my next one. Speaking of pure class, I know your relationship with Buck O'Neill was special. Just talk about how that developed and what Buck meant to you. And for those people who aren't as familiar with his impact in the game, just tell a little bit about who Buck O'Neill was and then how you became such close friends and what he meant to you.
Well, there's a long answer for that one. I'll try to make it as short as possible. I mean, Buck O'Neill was a great player manager in the Negro Leagues. He was a scout for the major leagues, who scouted Lou Brock and was involved in countless others. Lee Smith, who's now in the Hall of Fame, he scouted Lee Smith, he scouted Joe Carter, very involved in the scouting of Ernie Banks, so on and so on. He was the first African-American coach in the major leagues for the Chicago Cubs in 1962. And more than anything, I think he was just a spokesman for the game, a spokesman for the Negro Leagues, of course, one of the founders, and I think the key founder of the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum there in Kansas City. There's nobody who's lived a life quite like Buck O'Neill. And this is not just my opinion. I mean, you right. walk in the doors of the Hall of Fame in Cooperstown, and there's one statue that greets you, and it's the statue of Buck O'Neill. So that tells you the impact that he had on baseball and on countless people. I, as columnist for the Kansas City Star, got to know Buck a little bit. Yeah. If you're in Kansas City, I'm sure you knew Buck. We all get to know him a little bit. We just started developing a little bit of a friendship and a relationship, and he would call me now and again to talk to me about stuff. And then I told this many times, but it's true. We would have lunches occasionally, particularly there used to be a great restaurant right next to the museum called Peachtree, mm-hmm. where they served soul food, and it was incredible. So one day we're meeting at the Peachtree, and it was just me and him, and he had something on his mind, and he said, you know, I think somebody needs to write a book about the Negro Leagues. Somebody needs to write a book that tells the true story, not the hardship, not the, the pain, which is of course all a part of it.
Sure.
But somebody needs to talk about how great it was, how joyful it was, how fun it was. And he just kept saying that somebody needs to write this book. I was the only one there. So, I mean, it was pretty clear that he was
hinting very well. Huh?
Yeah. He met me. And so I wanted to write that book, and I tried to figure out how to write that book. And I tried and tried. I mean, it took me a couple of years to really figure out what would that book even look like. And at that time, Buck had already written his own book. He'd already written his biography. So I was trying to think of a way to write this book, and I really couldn't. And then it clicked and it hit me, and the book needed to be about Buck. And even though he had written his own book, and that's what led to The Soul of Baseball, where I traveled around the country with Buck as he told the story of the Negro Leagues, and we spent that year together. And by then we were very close already, but that year brought us much closer together, along with Bob Kendrick, who was there for almost all of it. To be perfectly honest, became like brothers as we traveled the country and then listen to Buck tell the same stories. It was just joyful. And then of course it led to when it looked like Buck was going to go into the Baseball Hall of Fame and him falling short of the vote, and then him going to Cooperstown to speak anyway, even though they hadn't voted him in, and what a graceful thing that was. And then him dying 2 months later. I mean, it's amazing for a man who lived such a long life that the end felt like such a whirlwind, but it did. And my book, I literally finished my book a couple of weeks before Buck died. Got to tell him that I'd finished it, but I never got to read it to him. And so I say this, and it's 100% true. One way or another, I think about Buck O'Neill every single day. It's not always specifically a story, but it's always something he'd said to me or some way he'd looked at the world. I think with everything going on in the world now, I think about Buck more than ever. How would he feel about, you know, all of these things that we're seeing all around us? He was just the most peaceful and most optimistic person I've ever been around. And I wish I could take some of that with me and have tried 30 years to take some of that with me.
My favorite quote, and I've talked to Bob about this quite often, my favorite Buck O'Neill quote was, "Don't feel bad for those of us who played in the Negro Leagues that we didn't get to play in the major leagues. Feel bad for the people who only watch Major League Baseball who didn't get to see us play." And I may be butchering it, but that's the gist of it.
No, that's right.
You know, Buck was, for all that he went through, and he went through some really, really tough things. He was, you said peaceful, and I think that's a great word. He was not bitter at all. You know, he came and spoke for us at the Fellowship of Christian Athletes, spoke in our chapel and talked about, you know, God doesn't want us to be bitter. And he always looked at the bright side of everything. Buck would be able to, if he were sitting here, if we were doing a three-way, he would be able to tell us the positives that came from the coronavirus.
Right. No, that's right.
Because
that's
he was 100%. So positive.
So positive. I always tell the story about, you know, this time we were in Houston and it was the end of a long day and Buck was really tired and we were getting ready to go. It was very hot. And one of the Astros players threw a ball into the stands trying to throw it to a kid, and an adult kind of reached in front of him and caught the ball. And I said, oh man, what a jerk, you know, catching that ball, taking it from the kid. And Buck was not paying attention. He said, what are you talking about? I said, oh, that guy down there, he just took that ball from that kid. And Buck like immediately said, well, you know, don't be so hard on him. Maybe he's got a kid of his own at home. Like that was the way that Buck thought.
Yeah.
And I remember sitting there and thinking, you know, this, how positive can you be? And then it hit me. And I said, Buck, wait a minute. If that guy's got a kid, you know, if this guy's got a kid, why didn't he bring the kid to the ball game?
Yeah. Yeah.
And Buck said, maybe his kid is sick. And I thought, yeah, I'm never beating him at this game. Ever. You know, this
is, yeah.
You're yeah. never going to break through. And look, he was relentless about his optimism, relentless about his, it didn't come easily. It was something he worked at constantly, that he was not going to let the haters win. He was not going to let the racists have the last word. I mean, he was not naive. He was not unaware of all that he'd had to endure. He just wasn't going to let that embitter him. And he never did. And it was like I say, he inspired me constantly.
Yeah. I had several other questions to wrap up with, but that's a great way to wrap up. And let me ask it this way. And obviously I didn't prepare this question, but how can you carry that with you? That constant optimism, not Pollyanna, not, you know, whistling through the graveyard or anything like that, any of those expressions, but to be able to look for the positive in every difficult situation. How do you take that with you?
I think what I try to do is I try to think of, because there were plenty of times when I saw Buck, you know, exhausted, down. I've seen him where he was, you know, I remember in New York, we did an interview. He did an interview with a shock jock in New York, and it was very contentious and ugly and did not go well. And I've seen Buck at those moments where he could go the other way, you know, where he could just stop for, and who would even blame him, right?
Right.
And stop and say, oh, I didn't even get to go to the white high school when I grew up, you know, I didn't get a chance to manage in the major leagues. He would have been such a great major league manager, but he never, ever, I never saw him do it. I never saw him give in to those instincts. And I really truly believe it was an effort for him. I mean, it was, you know, and so that's what I fail to do, but try to do all the time. And that is make the effort to see the positive part, you know, make the effort to see the hopeful part of whatever it is. And it's, I fall down all the time trying to do that, but that's what I take from Buck. That's why I think about Buck every day. I'll see a piece of news that makes me angry or I'll run into something that I think is unfair and I'll stop and think, all right, think about Buck and think about what Buck would say, what would Buck do? And you know, sometimes it works. I can't say it works all the time, but sometimes it works. Sometimes I really am able to pull myself out from that spiral and try to, you know, Bob Kendrick uses that all the time. We're always trying to be more Buck-like.
Yeah.
We're failing, but we're always trying. And I do. I carry that with me all the time.
All right. Well, Joe, it's always good to catch up with you. Good to see you as best we can. Hopefully very soon we'll see you at a ball game or at some sporting event.
I hope so too. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to Sports Connections with David Smale. Make sure to subscribe, follow, and rate the show from your favorite podcast platform. You can learn more about David Smale and his work by visiting davidsmalebooks.com. Don't forget to join us weekly for new episodes. Until next time.